If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The 2025 Missouri legislative session is almost here, and with it, a new class of representatives and senators. One of those new senators is Curtis Gregory, who, after 4 years in the Missouri House, will represent the 21st District in the State Senate. On this episode of Politically Speaking, Gregory joins the show to talk about how he became involved in state politics, why he made the jump to the Senate, and his thoughts on the upcoming session. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's Statehouse and Politics reporter, Sarah Kellogg. Joining me is my co-host, his St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And joining us is a first-time guest. He is the Senator-elect for Missouri Senate District 21.
Curtis Gregory.
Thank you for being on the show. We're super excited to have you. We love having new guests. And so, as custom with new guests, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background before you decided to dive into Missouri politics.
Well, it could be a long story here, but we'll try and go as abbreviated as we can. So, grew up on a farm. The easiest way to describe where I grew up at, like many small town people do, out in the middle of nowhere, 7 miles north of Sweet Springs. So I had a Sweet Springs phone number, but then I had a Blackburn address. I went to school in Alma, which is about 20 minutes away from where I grew up, but we did all of our shopping in Marshall. So you just kind of, as I referenced earlier, we were talking off air, like town is Marshall, city is St. Louis. So the country folks say, oh, I got to go to town, and well, I'm coming to the city now. Like St. Louis is the city. Went to high school in Alma, Santa Fe High School, was good enough to play football, so got a scholarship at the University of Missouri, just like you two fine folks, was able to get my degree. Then after that, small stint of a career in the NFL, went to training camp with the Panthers as an undrafted rookie free agent. And when that glorious career ended, went back to the farm and, you know, basically farmed full time from 2013 through 2018, some small odd jobs here and there. The political itch really started when I got involved with the Missouri Corn Growers Association. And you know, one of the things they emphasize is going to talk to legislators, because if you don't go tell your story, and I tell this to any group I speak with, from, you know, dog owners to city clerks to county clerks to moms that are in my office, like, hey, I appreciate you coming down and telling your story, because if I don't have your opinion, I'm going to make up my own thought process towards something. And we may not agree on the issues, but at least I know from you what you feel like. And that's one of the things that they told us about, is go talk to your legislators. We got to tell our story as farmers and ranchers and those in agriculture. And it started being, I think that's something I can do. So this is the 2016 or 13 through 16 timeframe. I actually wanted to get off corn growers, because at the time when I was on, you could do 3 years at the, or 6 years at the state level. You could do 9 if you went on the national board. If you get on the national board, you get to go travel a lot more, do trade mission trips. But I just had a kid, wanted to stay home, be more involved. Well, then 3 short years later, politics comes knocking. And that's when I ran for the state house in November of 2020. And so that's where I've been ever since.
So you were a Missouri Tiger on the team from 2006 to 2009. Tell us about that experience. How do you think it influences you today?
So where I grew up at, you know, out in the country, you know, you don't have a very diverse population. Number one, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the simple, the way of life. And so you grow up around what you're used to. And so my first day, you know, on the football team, I'm in a completely different environment, and just getting to learn that, you know, some kids didn't grow up with both a mom and dad. Some kids had literally no money growing up. I've sat on the floor with my name, image, and likeness legislation that I had teammates that the very first game their parents ever got to come watch them play was senior day, because they made sure they wanted to get there for that. And that's why I thought it was important to pass name, image, and likeness so there could be some extra money. I had teammates that slept on a couch in another person's apartment, and they were sending their entire scholarship stipend back home to help take care of their brothers and sisters. And so just gaining that bigger influence, that bigger picture of different ideas and opinions and views than what I would have gotten had I just went to, say, you know, Missouri Valley College or State Fair and just stayed on the farm the whole time.
I do have to ask, since you were on the 2007 team, my favorite Mizzou team of all time, what was your reaction when you all found out that Kansas was going to make a BCS game, even though you beat them in probably one of the greatest games in Mizzou history? Did you want to, like, throw something through a wall? Because I certainly did.
Absolutely. Felt like we got the shaft. You know, it was Armageddon at Arrowhead. We felt like we got we had to go play. We win that game at Arrowhead against Kansas. We had the same records. We're the number one team in the country. We had a rematch with Oklahoma, whom we lost to in a close game in Norman earlier in the year. And we play a very close game again down in San Antonio, but we were without Chase Kaufman in that game. We were without Pig Brown, one of our safeties, in that game because he blew his Achilles against Iowa State. And I feel like we might have been down another receiver also. And so if we would have been full strength, I firmly believe we beat Oklahoma and San Antonio. We play in the Natty, but we lost, and it's like we got punished for going to the Big 12 championship game.
It is a disgrace, and it's why I think you should file legislation to repeal, go back in time and prevent Kansas from going to that game. But
it all worked out, though. You know, that was the flip side of things, that the BCS game would have been the Orange Bowl down in Florida. Florida at that time wasn't much of a recruiting hotbed for us, but the state of Texas was. So the reward that we got was we got to go play in Dallas in the Cotton Bowl against a lesser football conference, the SEC, right? Because at the time, you know, Big 12 was where real football was played in the Big 12, and we got to go thump Darren McFadden and Felix Jones, and it was just a good time.
So fast forward to your first term in the Missouri House, kind of what made you decide to run for the House? I know you said, you know, mentioning kind of getting to that path, but why the House specifically?
Well, at the time, Representative Dean Dorbin was terming out. I want to say that we had a close relationship, but a little bit of a relationship. And, you know, the phone calls start happening when he enters his last term of who we're going to get to run. I fielded some of those phone calls and, you know, just talked about it. And it was something at that point in time. Not saying that Donald Trump is an ordinary person in any stretch of the imagination, but he was a normal dude. He wasn't a senator. He's never been a governor. He ran for president, so I'm sure that got a lot more people thinking that, hey, I can do this too, type of a deal. So that was kind of wheels turning and just, I want to do politics at some point in time. I don't know when the right time is, and the opportunity presented itself, and that was the door I walked through, and just wanted to get involved and be that voice for, you know, rural Missouri and agriculture and see what we can do.
You mentioned this earlier, but while you were in the House, you know, you were a driving force in getting Missouri's name and likeness bills passed. You know, first for our listeners, tell us a little bit about, like, what NIL is, for those who might just hear the acronym and be like, I don't know what the heck you're talking about.
So name, image, and likeness, it started in California. Some good policies that start in California. You probably don't realize it until you're in back then, until you're an older player. You know, once I got to be older, we shot some videos for season ticket sales or pictures for billboards or things like that. Like, they're using me to promote season ticket sales. So that was cool because you saw yourself on television. But then once name, image, and likeness started coming up, and then you start hearing about such and such college athlete sold some rap songs on Spotify, he's now ineligible, or had to make the decision to enter this business opportunity but couldn't do it if you continue to play football, so I'm going to quit playing football so I can pursue this business opportunity. And so when I started talking with fellow legislators, when now Senator Nick Shore actually brought the First Amendment up about name, image, and likeness, and I said, yeah, this is true. If I get a scholarship to university as a band student, then maybe I'm a really good piano player is the example I think I used. A university scholarship to play the piano, I can be at college, I can get paid for recording and doing concerts as a piano player. But if I was that same piano player that's happened to be good at football, I could not do and earn a cent off of my ability to play the piano because the NCAA viewed me using my football likeness to promote my music. So what are we saying for people that want to be, you know, quote unquote, you know, free market, you know, capitalism of start a business, earn something off yourself. So I was happy to join on with Shore and work through that first iteration that we did. I told those stories about my teammates not being able to have money for their folks to come to games. You know, almost think there should be an NCAA fund that is a travel fund for parents to go watch their kids play, because I was blessed. I think there was only one game in my high school and college career that my folks didn't make it to. They drove to Albuquerque, New Mexico. They drove to, you know, Colorado and Dallas and San Antonio. They went everywhere. And so to me, it was important to make sure that players now were able to access those same opportunities.
You know, critics of NIL say that, you know, along with kind of the transfer portal, you know, players earning money this way, being able to change schools, has really fundamentally changed the sport.
Absolutely.
What are your thoughts on that?
Honestly, look at the records this year. There is no one or two teams that are sitting at the top with an undefeated record. Look at the SEC this year. Missouri beats Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt beats Alabama. Just the plurality of college football and almost even basketball now, of the good players are going where they know they can be a name. They're going to be able to make some money. I also think it's good because if I would have made $500,000 in college, I might not have tried for the NFL. By the time I came out of college, I had 6 different surgeries. So my body was broke down. The Cincinnati Bengals were honest with me. They said, "We're not drafting you because your body is messed up. We love you as a player, but you're too big of an injury risk." And so it gives those guys an opportunity that may never make a dime off of their athletic talent to make something in college to start their lives.
You know, you were also the sponsor of legislation that reauthorized a tax credit for film projects in Missouri, you know, TV, movies, commercials, et cetera. Why did you sponsor this bill?
So that's actually my legislative assistant. I don't remember. It was during an interim at one point in time. He said, "What do you think about film tax credits?" And I was like, "I don't know. You tell me what you know about it." And that's your summer project, TC. You go figure this out. And so we looked at it. The actual Senate sponsor of the bill that passed is Senator Denny Hoskins, now Secretary of State-elect Denny Hoskins. And we talked about it. And one of the most popular shows on Netflix ever is what? Do we know what that is?
Ozark.
Guess where that show was filmed?
Arkansas, or was it Georgia?
Georgia. Now they came to the lake and shot some B-roll footage. But if you talk to people at the lake, they say, we have visitors all the time asking about the show Ozark, and, well, it wasn't filmed here. There was opportunities for shows to get filmed in Missouri, but they just left because there was no incentive. Number one question when someone calls, "We want to film in Missouri," was there an incentive? Nope. Oh, conversation's over. Like, there was no, "This is what we have to offer." And I feel like Missouri's got a lot to offer from our landscapes. You got St. Louis. You've got Kansas City. You've got Silver Dollar City down in Branson. Then you take it down to the smaller levels. We've got Arrow Rock right there in Saline County. It's a historic town where they are very period, like you have to fit in this rigid structure of period time on remodels and buildings. Like, you could go probably anywhere from 1820s to 1920s and film something there. Mm-hmm. So I felt like Missouri is missing out on an opportunity. The biggest one we missed out on, and I talked about this on the floor when the bill was on the floor, the show Tulsa King, Sylvester Stallone, the same people that did Yellowstone. That show is supposed to have been called Kansas City King, referencing Kansas City's mob history in the 1920s, the Pendergrass crime syndicate. But since Missouri did not have that film incentive, that got moved to Tulsa. When you watched Yellowstone, when season 5 first started, how many advertisements did you see for Tulsa King? A lot. 14 million people watched the season premiere of Yellowstone that one specific year. So the amount of dollars in just earned media attention the state of Missouri could have gotten if that show was Kansas City King, Sylvester Stallone filming here, and then what it does for those tourist attractions from that point on, I think is just, it's a smart play. And one of the first films was filmed right here in St. Louis on fire.
All right, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest today is Senator-elect Curtis Gregory. So let's get right into your upcoming tenure in the Senate. So only 2 terms into your House tenure, you decided to run for state Senate. Why did you make that move?
Term limits plays a big part in it. Right now in Missouri, you get 8 years in the House and you get 8 years in the Senate. So 4 2-year terms in the House, 2 4-year terms in the Senate. And if you don't make that jump when the opportunity presents itself, so in my case, I would have stayed in the House for another 4 years. And then if I wanted to move on in politics, I would have had to have chose to run statewide at that point or challenge an incumbent senator or sit out for 4 years and then run again. And it said, well, by the time you sit out for 4 years, you're going to be old news. And so the opportunity came open. Districts changed because the way the 21st sat before, we were in Johnson. Selena was in Johnson County. I would have been looking at a run against Representative Houks out of Johnson County, which is the bigger population county. That would have been somewhat challenging. So the districts changed, an opportunity to run clean and get away from Representative Houks. And you know, there again, the opportunity presented itself to go represent a wholly ag district with all the counties that are in it. And so we decided to make the jump and take a chance.
You ran against State Representative Doug Ritchie, who is a Republican from Clay County. This was one of the most competitive Senate primaries in 2024. What was it like running in that contest?
I feel like as a whole, at the end of the day, it probably made me, I don't want to use the word better politician because that just sounds so bad. I just want to be a good representative of people. I don't want to say better politician, but when I say better politician, I mean, I had to go campaign. My House races were easy. It was the towns I grew up in. Everybody knew me. And so I had to get out and travel. I had to actually go knock doors for the first time. I remember calling friends that knocked doors. How do you knock doors? I've never had to do it. Where do you park? You just park in front of somebody's house and just take off? Like, yep, that's what you do. Wild to me from growing up in the country. You just randomly park in front of someone's house in some random neighborhood in Liberty or Kearney or Smithville and just go take off walking and start knocking doors. And so it was a tough race. If you would have asked me in like June 15th, I'd have said, I don't know, I feel like it's pretty neck and neck. But we ran a really good campaign. I felt like we ran a really positive campaign. We talked about myself, what I felt like we were going to do and bring to the district and bring to the Senate. And it was finally, I think it was the day that early voting started. I had about an 8-hour day of knocking doors in, I think I was in Liberty that day. And I called my campaign manager, and I, instead of saying, I think I'm going to win, that was the day I said, I'm going to win this, because out of the 100 or so doors I knocked that day and the 50 of them that I actually talked to, we're going to vote for you, or we've already voted for you at that point in time. And I knew if I performed like 30% or above in Clay County, that the rural counties would, I had to win by less of a margin in the rural areas. And then when I did the math on kind of numbers, if I achieved 40% in Clay County, I could have won the rurals by like 52-53%. And I knew I was going to win the rural counties by more than that and ended up winning by 13% overall.
Ritchie was notably a member of the Freedom Caucus, and which you are not a member of. Do you think that may have played a factor in the election? And kind of what's your take on the Freedom Caucus?
You know, it might have on both ways. That definitely lost me some support with people because that's the path they want to go down. It probably gained me some support with some people. I would be knocking on doors of people that told me they voted Republican their entire life and they were not going to vote Republican anymore because of some of those antics. And I said, I'm your guy. Like, I'm even keeled. I agree with a lot of virtually everything they've tried getting done. Like, you look at 24 session initial petition reform, I voted for that every time. I just probably didn't agree with the tactics they were using to try and get that brought to the forefront. And so it was what it was. He had his lane, I had my lane, and we ran our races.
You're the second person in recent weeks to say, when I was knocking on doors of normal people, they knew what was happening in the Senate, like with the Freedom Caucus and the obstruction. Did that surprise you? Because if that happened to me, I would be like, wow, you actually pay attention to Missouri politics?
And I don't know if it was necessarily Missouri politics or federal level politics that they were referencing. But just as far as that particular conversation was going, I said, you know, I hear you. That is not how I plan to act. And I said, I have thought about that. You know, what issue would it take for me to want to shut things down and say that what I have in my legislation is important to the people of the 21st district and the people of the state of Missouri? What would that be? At this point, I probably can't answer that question. But, you know, wholly, I've agreed with initiative petition reform and many of the other issues that have been, maybe we need to take a look at property tax. That's been another issue. So let's see what it is. But wholly, like I said, I ran my lane and I told myself, if I can't win this race being Curtis Gregory, then why am I in politics? If I have to act different because I'm in this election and I know my opponent is Freedom Caucus, if I have to act Freedom Caucus to win this, even though I'm not, then why am I in politics?
And you're not going to be. You're not joining the Freedom Caucus.
No, I definitely, I'm not going to. I'm going to be in the Republican Caucus. And I feel like, you know, there's just been a lot of division caused by it, a lot of infighting that's not necessary. We should all be basking in the glow of the victory that President-elect Trump had in November, what we were able to pull off in Missouri. You look at the legislative races across the state of Missouri where the Senate numbers stayed the same. The districts that were expected to flip, Boone County was expected to go Democrat. Senator-elect Stephen Weber won that one. The district that was expected to go Republican, Senator-elect Nicola won that race. You look at the House districts, Republicans still maintain a supermajority there with 111 seats. We lost one, but we gained one. Representative Lonsdale's district flipped. And then Representative, he was the Republican, flipped Democrat, but then Representative Jamie Johnson, Democrat, flipped Republican. So we had tradesies, so to speak. And so the numbers stayed the same. So I think that just on a night like that, when President Trump wins across the nation the way that he does, if Republicans were going to gain seats, it would have happened. But it didn't. And so that just tells me, like, maybe the districts are actually drawn really good right now.
Before we get into specific issues, what is some legislation that you're wanting to get done personally? You know, pie in the sky, big dreams as far as like your first term.
So first term, you know, what I, two of the things I have in my top three. So the last couple of years I've ran some legislation for Missouri Farm Bureau to be able to sell health coverage. I think there's nine or 10 other states now. It really kind of started in Tennessee. I just believe it's a good model. About 10% of all people go without health coverage. I was actually one of those 10% for a couple of years because the cost of buying off the exchange, I was like, I'm not paying that. But then I'm an accident-prone individual. I've got many scars from farm accidents, and you're dumb not to have something. So I do believe that's an issue. So that's something I've worked on the last 2 years. Now I'm in the Senate. That's my number one. Number two is name, image, and likeness. For the simple fact, there's this, it's called the House Settlement. It's a federal case now that I think is going to change the dynamic of how name, image, and likeness is paid to more of a revenue sharing model. And so what we currently have on the books would be in direct conflict with what's going to come out of that settlement. So I needed to make sure we had a vehicle ready for that to move, because tertiary information I've heard is there could potentially be major penalties for SEC schools if they don't fall under, you know, what the SEC presidents have voted on. Then the third one is in my top three. It's just we didn't have some other things filed yet, but the top three are what gains the most of your attention is updating fireworks regulations. I know we kind of chuckle, right? Because you would think it's maybe not important, but have some constituents that are very close to the district, if not in the district, that a lot of definitions in that have changed and how some of these shows can be shot off. So it was important to some constituents of the district, and so that's why that one went in the top three.
Well, let's get to some of the issues. For Governor-elect Mike Kehoe, crime is a big priority. He's talked a lot about crime in St. Louis, like having the state basically oversee the St. Louis Police Department. But I'm actually more interested in what you want the governor to do about rural crime, because this idea that there's no crime in rural counties is a myth, and I'm sure you know that firsthand. And I'm also sure that you probably want state assistance for things like that. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
You know, out in the rural areas, you know, it's just different. You know, you think about a sheriff's office, you know, Saline County is actually just looked it up yesterday, was trying, my wife, we were in Cooper County, and well, what's a Cooper? Well, someone that makes a barrel. And I was like, well, I wonder if Cooper County was named after a barrel maker. Well, no, it wasn't. So I looked up Saline County. It's like over it's like 700 square miles, and we've got 12 deputies. And so there's a lot of the small towns that rely on sheriff's deputies to try and come in. So, we did pass a sheriff's pay increase a couple of years ago that some counties weren't happy about because it was an unfunded mandate, of which I understand. But if you're not going to pay for a position, how do you expect to get a good person in there? So maybe addressing, funding needs for those rural policing districts, sheriff's offices, what have you, making sure we have good prosecutors, which is an elected position all across the state. You'd hear about that. We had the issue here in St. Louis. There was kind of a similar issue in Jackson County with a prosecutor that was more apt to prosecute an officer for arresting someone than actually prosecuting the person that was arrested for the crime that they were arrested for. And so just making sure that we're going to get after the people that are actually doing wrong as opposed to the people that are trying to bring those bad guys off the street. So just more funding would probably help the rural areas out the best.
How much of the 2025 session do you expect to be focused on responding to the passage of Amendment 3, which legalized abortion in Missouri?
That is something we talked about a little bit at Senate caucus. I don't know if it'll be addressed. I think, the waters could be tested in 25. And I think as Republicans, we need to sit back and take a look. If we run under the hypothesis that someone that votes for Curtis Gregory, the Republican for state Senate, that they were a no on Amendment 3, and my rural counties, if I got 1,000 votes for me for Senate, there was 750 no votes on Amendment 3. So 25% roughly on, back of the envelope math, the people that voted for me for state Senate then voted in favor of Amendment 3 instead of no. And so that question is why? Why did you support that? Is it because you didn't know what we currently had in place? Is it because I've talked to some Republican female voters in the primary cycle that said it should be 100% my choice and I am a true red-blooded Republican voter. So they're 100% on that side of the issue. But where is that compromise line at? And, test the waters and find out what that is.
Yeah, a lot of your colleagues have proposed things that are similar to the abortion ban that is technically inoperable as we record this, with some slight changes, like maybe there's a broader health exception or rape and incest exception, but still there's a 0 weeks window. I think that if you put that on the ballot, that will not pass in 2026. I think the only way that you're going to be able to repeal and replace is if there's some sort of span of time somebody can get an abortion for any reason. I mean, even Donald Trump said when he was asked, what do you think about the 6-week ban in Florida? He said it was too short. Like, he doesn't support a 0-week ban. And I don't think Republican voters support that. But I can imagine some of your colleagues are going to be really skittish about putting that up for the ballot, because do they really want to put in the Constitution that you can get an abortion after 8 or 12 weeks if they think it's murder? I think the answer is no for them.
I think wholly, Republican pro-lifers, it's a rough issue. In my primary cycle, Representative Ritchie got the pro-life endorsement, and so that came up in forums. What is your stance and what is your belief? And it's been, I've talked about it with people for a while, like just not this summer, but over a couple of years. And Missouri not having that rape and incest exception. I've talked to representatives that voted on the heartbeat bill saying, maybe we ought to have that in there. And they said, Roe will never get overturned. We'll be fine. Or we're never going to have to deal with it. But here we are now, right? And
yeah.
So we're dealing with something that 3 years ago, if that was in, would Amendment of 3 passed? I don't know. I don't think it would have as close as it is.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but like if it had remained an 8-week abortion ban, which it was when it passed in 2019, but it also contained the trigger law, which then banned pretty much all abortions. No, I don't think there would have been an Amendment 3. I mean, I don't think the money or the enthusiasm from outside groups would have been there to overturn an 8-week abortion ban, but there certainly was a lot of enthusiasm everywhere to overturn a 0-week abortion ban. Because again, I would argue that's not the mainstream of what the Republican Party wants.
Right, so I had to, I am definitely pro-life, like I am proudly pro-life, but I've found that means different things to different people, and those conversations have had to have been had since Roe was overturned. And so as I started thinking about it, I've got a 10-year-old daughter, and this is what I went with. I, Curtis Gregory, the human being, firmly believe that killing an unborn child is wrong. Firmly believe it. I think we're nodding heads here. Like, we can agree with that. But I don't think me as a human being can look the mother of a 13-year-old daughter that's been brutally raped in the eye and say, she's got to carry that kid to term. I, as a person and a human being, the answer of I hope to never be put in that situation as a lawmaker, in my opinion, isn't good enough. And so I still don't think it's right, but I still as a person, I don't think that I could support something like that. And so some of the legislation that has been filed does have that compromise position in it. And so we'll just have to see where that takes us. So as to answer your question of how much time is spent on it, I have no idea.
I think it could be a 2026 issue, because if you're putting it on the ballot, like, it'll be in 2026. So it may be testing the waters this year and then maybe putting something on the ballot next year.
On the flip side, what I've heard, we're not exactly sure what all Amendment 3 overturns and what we've passed yet. That was something that I've heard, that people that were trying to draft legislation, drafters were saying, we don't know what's coming out, what's staying in. Yeah. Here it's going to be. Some stuff still has to go through the courts to figure out what's coming out. So we don't even know how to draft the legislation yet to know where we can go back to.
You mentioned initiative petition reform. Is that just going to be on hold until something passes that changes or repeals Amendment 3? Because you raise the bar to like 60% or 4 or 5 congressional districts, and Amendment 3 is still in there, and that passes. Amendment 3 will be in the Constitution basically forever after that. So, like, how does that affect that issue?
So it did not actually get passed in 24. I think the best shot we had was in 2023, when we actually it was just a straight percentage increase going from 50% plus one person to get it to like 50.0001% in favor to make it pass to, I think it was like a 55%. The House passed it. The Senate gets it. They change it to like 60. The House goes, we want to go to conference, which is where certain House members and certain senators sit down around a table and go, hey, guys, like, where can we meet at? There was a conference committee report that came out of it. I feel like it was 55%. Sarah, if you
think it was 57, was it 57?
I think it was 57. Yeah, in the end, it was somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, and then it kind of morphed into this concurrent majority thing.
So in 2023, I think it was like May 8th or 9th, the House then passes the conference committee report. So then it goes to the Senate on May 9th for one more vote, and then it's truly agreed and finally passed for the governor to sign and put that into law and to get it on the ballot at some point in time. Just a straight percentage threshold increase. But due to members of the Senate filibustering, it did not get an opportunity at that one more vote. And then you come to the 2024 session, and all of a sudden, initiative petition reform is the number one issue, and saying, you know, we have to get this done, and we can't believe it's not gotten done. But in 2023, they were holding the floor up when initiative petition reform was one vote away from getting done with the straight percentage increase. So for Amendment 3 this year, those blaming not getting initiative petition reform done in 2024, we're operating, number one, under the assumption that what we pass doesn't have a lawsuit against it, which I'm sure it would have. We would have had to have gone to the courts to see if our language is good enough, number one. Then we're operating under the assumption, number two, that it passes on the ballot because it's a constitutional change. So we're operating under the assumption that it passes in August. And then we're operating under the assumption that the pro-abortion people aren't going to sue and say, well, we don't have to fall under the guise of that because we collected signatures and we're certified to go on the ballot before this passes.
It wouldn't just be the abortion. It would have been the sports betting people, too.
It would have been everybody. And so there's a lot of fallacies out there that saying it's the failure of the legislature to pass, of not passing IP reform in 24 is why we have Amendment 3. I agree with that to points, but you're operating with the fallacies or the thoughts that it was instantly going to pass. And so the issues with it, I'm easy here to say it, the single sentence message on this petition reform change, if you're against it, is the legislators are trying to take away your right to change the Constitution. That's it. That's one sentence. It's tough to defend. We have to have a conversation of why we need to do it, because it's become too easy. And that's how a lot of things have ended up in the Constitution.
To circle back to Jason's question, do you think that's going to be harder to do now because abortion is in the Constitution?
I think it was always going to be hard to do, number one. But, you know, let's sit back and think about it. When you look at the pro-abortion issue, Michael Bloomberg was sending money to the state of Missouri. Out-of-state interest. We had out-of-state people coming in to collect signatures. It was probably really good for the Missouri economy. You know, thank you all of the out-of-state people for sending the tens of millions of dollars that came into Missouri to be spent on ads and signs and, you know, everything else. So thanks for boosting the economy a little bit. But when we're looking at all of these out-of-state interests coming in to try and change how we do things in the state of Missouri, I think that's something that needs a long, hard look at and the people that have an opportunity to have a say in.
Not to be argumentative, I mean, just a little bit.
No, that's fine. That's what we're here for.
FanDuel and DraftKings are
They spend a lot of money, too. I'm not trying to...
I want to just point that out. And I will just also say that was a very self-serving initiative because now you can only have two apps. My dream of creating Rosenbets is dashed.
Let's start an initial petition right now to add Rosenbets to the Missouri State Constitution as a sports betting platform.
Let's not, because I actually don't like sports betting, but that's a whole other story.
Kind of our last question is, I know, obviously, being a farmer yourself, are there any issues other than the ones you mentioned, like as far as agriculture, that you think should be addressed this session?
You know, I've got legislation filed to repeal, I believe, the sunsets and some of the agricultural tax credits, which are the most successful tax credit programs the state has. It drives a lot of innovation. Agriculture is the number one industry in the state. You know, St. Louis County is actually the biggest ag economy that there is. Kind of like, you got to be kidding me. But when you think about what's here with the research and Bayer and everything that goes on, okay, that makes sense. I'm down with that. Like, I jive. So just taking a look at that, water rights is a big issue. There's been companies talk about using abandoned pipelines to ship water out of state to, you know, the southwestern United States. I think Senator like Jamie Berger tried tackling that last year. So those are a couple of issues. I like being forward thinking. I'm talking to some dairy folks in meat packing. You know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Do we want to increase slaughter capacity in the state first, or do we increase feedlot capacity in the state first? Well, I don't think you're going to increase feedlot capacity until you have slaughter capacity. There's a plant being built in Warrenton right now, and so I'll be curious to see what that does for the Missouri cattle industry. I look forward to potentially working on some stuff in the dairy market. The central United States is the dairy desert. There's a lot of milk shipped in. So we've got trucks on the road carrying milk to the central United States to be further processed and packaged, sent to your local grocery stores. So I would like to get those dairies back here because we have the water. We've got the feedstocks and just figure out what that might look like to attract some dairies back to Missouri.
Well, Senator-elect Gregory, I think we could talk to you for a lot longer, but I think we are out of time. We thank you for being on the show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is owned by the University of Missouri, St. Louis. You can find all of our work at stlpr.org. And Senator Gregory, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
So Facebook, I got the old Facebook page, you know, Curtis Gregory for Missouri, I think is probably where I do most of my stuff. The web page is there, Gregory for, I think it's Gregory for Missouri or Gregory, I think it's Gregory for Mo. .com, not to be confused with my brother from another mother, David Gregory, who's also going to be a senator.
That's going to be very fun and confusing. I'm sure you're going to make jokes about that all the time.
I'm going to have to start writing Gregory 21 again. You know, the first 2 years in the House, I had to write Gregory 51 because he was Gregory 96. And so here we go. He's the easy way to tell us apart. I'm taller, not as much hair. He's shorter, got way better looking hair than I do.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And until next time, so long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Jason Rosenbaum, Rachel Lippman, and me, Sarah Kellogg. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts.